Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we are diving into narrative design with writer and game designer Ian Thomas. Ian is the founder of Tailspinners, the story for games company, and also the story lead at Frictional Games. Without further ado, let's descend. I guess my first question for you is narrative. Like, how did you know you wanted to be a writer? Did you always know, or was it something you kind of fell into?
Oh, that's a tricky one. It was a kind of weird path getting into it as well. I guess it's one of those things that started as a kid again, in that I was one of those kids who sat in the library too long and who made up things about, you know, made up stories about the toys you're playing with, all those kind of things. But hadn't seriously considered it as any kind of career at all, and actually headed in loads of different directions. Thought I was going to be a graphic artist for a while, did work in print workshops and things like that. And eventually, for some weird reason, ended up on computing science, possibly because I wanted to make games, possibly. Mm. But at that point, I didn't. And then ended, you know, a long, complicated route of working on, I guess, creative kind of tech. So stuff like interactive TV back in the day, but coding it, mm-hmm. running coding teams doing that stuff, and running coding teams working on educational discs for kids. So we were part of a cartoon studio at one point, taking all their old kind of line drawings, hand drawings, and painting them up in Photoshop and turning them into CD-ROMs.
Oh, cool.
Back in the day. Mm-hmm. And all of that stuff carried on. But in the background, I'd been doing role-playing for a very long time, mm-hmm. Making up stories for other people, and then started to write. And at the same time, my brother was getting into filmmaking. Mm-hmm. He was a prop and art guy on things like the Harry Potter series, that sort of thing. Quite big films. And then he wanted to get into directing, and he needed somebody to write the scripts. And meantime, I'd written a couple of books, and I'd written a kind of bunch of stuff in the background. And so really, I spent 8 to 10 hours a day working on my day job, which was running coding teams. And then another 8 to 10 hours,
yep.
In the evenings, trying to make all the rest of this stuff happen. And so eventually, happily, managed to collapse those two. So it was kind of half and half during the day job. I was involved in, it was when I first got working for Frictional, really. I was working on level design and code, but also story. And then eventually just saw the opportunity. I've been coding for so long now that every time you go to a new company, you write exactly the same piece of code you've written at every other company for the last 20 years. And just the opportunity to dump that, it came along. And
you took it.
And so here we are, really.
Yeah,
so it's a long, slow evolution. And I guess the advantage that I've got because of that is there's a whole load of writers who come into this without knowing the technical background as to what's going on. So it does help if you're doing things like procedural story, or you're trying to make your words work with a game engine in some way.
Or even branching narrative. Some writers don't understand like how important that is in a video game. I did read your blog post on how to get into it. And I thought it was funny because you had said almost everybody that you talk to has come into it in a different way, and that's the same for me. Everybody that I speak to that writes for games came into it in a weird way. It's rarely anybody said I want to write for video games.
I think it's changed now.
Mm-hmm.
I think the industry's kind of grown up, partly I think people have realized that story is a thing in games, but that's mm-hmm. only really mm-hmm. been true, apart from the edge cases, for maybe 10 years. It's only really been true.
You think
for that
so
long. I think so. I mean, there's one or two companies that were that absolutely, you know, they were all about the story all the way through.
Yeah.
But a lot of big AAA companies didn't really think about the story until they'd already got everything else working.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Still sometimes the case. I mean, I think the thing which opened my eyes a bit, I went to When GDC had an Austin event, they used to have the narrative part of GDC down in Austin, and everything else in Austin was mobile, and the sort of two sides didn't speak at all.
Yeah.
And I went down there 1 year, and it was a really small place. It was lovely because it was a tiny kind of almost mini convention for the narrative people, and it was pretty big names across the industry all in one small room. And what kind of opened my eyes a bit was that almost everybody there who'd been in it for a while came from a role-playing background. So all of these people who write Skyrim and did all the Obsidian stuff and all of that came from pen and paper. And it was kind of, oh, that's where they all went. Right, I get it.
So I've been dying to ask you about this as soon as I found out that you – So tell me about Talespinners.
There's sort of two or three things. So Talespinners itself is a company that we put together maybe 3 years ago now, specifically to help small to medium indie studios with story for their game. If they can't afford a full-time writer on staff, but they need somebody who can write dialogue and they can't do it, then they come out to us.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So we work with loads and loads of companies, mostly focusing on computer games, but diving a little bit into escape rooms, immersive events, all that kind of thing. And then the LARP writing stuff, really, I've been doing for probably 25 years now in various forms. And that, mostly it's a hobby, honestly. Most LARP companies, there's only one or two which actually make money out of this. So mostly it is, okay, we'll run an event this year and pull a small team together. And I've been working with that team and various teams, I guess, but on and off for a very long time now. So we've pulled together a way that we work and a way that we structure story and a way that we create story. And actually found it's very applicable to computer games. A lot of the stuff I use in computer games, I learned through trying to make sure that the player doesn't feel too railroaded. The player feels like they have all the choices they want to be able to make. And that came from LARP design, really.
So I've never done LARP. I've done a lot of tabletop gaming, but never LARP. So can you maybe tell me and the listeners kind of what that experience is like as a player? Like, do you come in and you've built a character prior to arriving, or?
Sure. So it depends on the LARP. I mean, it varies across the world how they work. But a kind of typical one is that you come in. Okay, there's a bunch of different ways of doing it. Yeah. Let's start with a one-off event. So this is an event which only exists for, say, the course of a weekend.
Yeah.
The story and characters only exist for that course of a weekend. So generally, you come into that knowing which character you're going to play. It could be something you've collaboratively made up with the designers. That's normally what happens. It could be something you've just come up with yourself from scratch with some guidelines as to what the world is like. And it might be that you've worked with some other players before the game to say, set up some relationships, you know, you're going to be my sister, this kind of thing. This is the shared history we have. And so the designers will have created a setting for you to drop into. And that could be just a backdrop. It could be, as we were at an event this weekend, which was basically Downton Abbey.
I know.
It was a wedding. So we get dropped into this family wedding, and it's not very structured, but everybody knows the structure of a wedding. You know, the night before, everybody drinks a little bit too much, and then you have the ceremony, and then you're trying to find the ring and this, that, and the other. So almost the organizers there are just providing a backdrop and a very basic structure and just letting people go.
That's incredible.
So that's more... Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's more almost kind of shared theatre, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And in those sort of events, often people have pre-planned what's going to happen to them. So they might already have worked out that they're going to discover they have a long-lost child or something like that. So it's quite theatrical. But on the other hand, you get events where we've played events and helped run events with up to about 3,000 people, which are basically Game of Thrones style events where you have multiple factions. You get dropped in as a small cog in a kind of big world. And you just have to go. You get basic rules. You get a background of how the world hangs together and who everybody is and what sort of costume you should probably wear if you want to be from this nation or that nation or the rest of it. And you just get told to go. And you could end up as empress of that nation, or you could end up, you know, dying forgotten in a field somewhere. So
that is so cool.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So when you're writing for like a LARP scenario, maybe even a small scale, like the Downton Abbey one that you did for a wedding, how many, I imagine you have like trees depending on, you know, what's going to happen. Cause it's like running a game, a tabletop game as a dungeon master or a game master, right? You have to have a whole bunch of different scenarios, or how do you prepare for that?
Yeah, it varies again per game. But what we tend to do is we don't really think about it in terms of branching trees like that. We tend to do this thing I use in computer game design, which I call moment-based design, which is essentially coming up with a bunch of things that you want your players to experience.
Yes, okay.
Scenes, particular scenes mm-hmm. you want to give them the opportunity to have. And then you roughly sketch out this is how I think these scenes will come together. But most of how you get to those scenes are driven by characters, mm-hmm. Actually, rather than a particular decisions a player takes. So if you take these loose scenes, like the moment where, let's say it was an Indiana Jones style game, mm-hmm. you want a scene where they open a tomb in the middle of a desert. You want a scene where they're flying from one country to another and there's a red line going across a map. You want a scene where they're in the Arabian souk and there's some confusion in trying to translate stuff between the guy selling the slightly dodgy items and you trying to buy them off him or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
And so we take those moments and we try and build ways that the players could have those moments. So in case of the archaeological tomb, obviously earlier in the game, somebody finds a map, somebody finds the location of the tomb. We have an art team go out and build the tomb. They fill it full of creepy crawlies and traps and things. And we don't know exactly when the players are going to hit that, but we're pretty sure that if we give them a tomb, they're going to go there. That's not going to be wasted.
Yeah.
But if it looks like they're going to miss it, we try and find a way that works for the story to direct them towards that. And if it doesn't work at all, we cut it and we do something else. But we try, you know, for expensive sets, obviously we try and get them there. And then things like the mistranslation in the Arabian souk, we'll give them the chance to visit the Arabian souk, and then we'll give them some language rules. And it's really up to them as to whether they have that nice moment occur where one person can understand both sides of the conversation and they're translating and lying as they translate between the two, if that makes sense. So we give these little moments, and that's based in the rule set. It's more of an opportunity to have a moment than it is necessarily here as a scripted scene that'll happen.
Yeah.
But it's pretty loose. And normally what happens is we sketch out how we think things will go and we impose a bit of structure, things like the wedding, which gives you a bit of structure, or a Christmas party, which mm-hmm. gives you a bit of structure. But we leave it pretty loose, and almost always there's a point in the event where all the organizers get together going, right, they've gone completely off the rails. how are we going to make it? How are we going to get to these scenes? How are we going to change things?
Yeah.
And that is part of the fun of it, honestly, because you're reacting in the moment to what your players are coming up with.
I was just going to ask you that, if you find, because you said you had written some books, and I actually didn't find that in my research of you. So I apologize for that. But do you find it more exciting, probably, the difference in sitting down and writing like a fictional novel versus, you know, you creating a live action story, is that your story can change and grow in a way that you weren't expecting it to? But sometimes you sit back and say, wow, that's better than probably what I would have done by myself.
Yeah, it's difficult. I think it's different. I think the thing which in a way LARP reminds me of is if you are writing for a computer game and you describe a scene of some sort and you send it off to a concept artist, and they'll always give you something back that's bigger and better than you imagined. They'll add things that you just, you know, that collaboration adds so much. And that's what's great about computer games, right? You're working with people who will always add things that surprise you. And that in LARP, happens in a moment, and that happens when somebody turns around and says a phrase that you didn't expect to take a direction. Yeah. And there's so much palpable emotion you can get out of those moments, and scenes which you thought were just going to be throwaway can turn into these really intense things. And the thing I kind of live for in that design, and I guess for computer games as well, but the thing I live for in a LARP design is the expression on people's faces, really, as they come across a moment or a thing that they are completely immersed on and can't believe is happening, if that makes sense.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Well, I just did my first GMing experience for a live audience. So I've done you know, GMing and things before for this, for, you know, small groups and things like that, but never for a live audience, like say on Twitch. And I just finished that this Halloween, and it was kind of a horror setting, but the reaction of both the audience and the players as either things happened or, you know, their experience is, it just takes it to another level for me as far as narrative goes. So I can definitely see how that can be very enticing and exciting, and I don't think I could go back to writing like little fiction bits after that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's that feedback loop,
yeah,
right?
And
we kind of get it as computer game designers, and that's where YouTube is amazing, or Twitch is amazing for us, because we can go and watch people's faces as they encounter a thing that we threw in.
How often do you go watch?
Honestly, if I'm feeling particularly down, I'll go back and watch the last few moments of Soma, just to watch people's faces, because you know there's rough bits in Soma, and there's bits which worked and bits which didn't. But the ending, I think, I was really, really happy with.
It was
and
very
just watching
good.
People's reactions to that ending is as the credits roll is great. So it's another thing that you get also on show floors and conventions and things. If you're demoing a game to people, particularly if it's not yet locked down and you're showing kind of early builds or whatever, it's a really good metric to just watch people's reactions and watch people's faces as they're playing the thing, because you find patterns. You always find patterns in that,
like, oh, they're getting stuck at this one particular spot, everybody is, or
sure. I mean, that's the sort of thing you'd find out in testing generally, hopefully. But testing, often you'll send builds off to people, and you'll get maybe some video back, and you'll get reports back, that kind of thing. But the advantage of being right next to somebody and just watching their face,
because you get to see their reaction and their excitement, like, right?
Yeah, completely.
Let's talk about Soma. I know you did a lot on that game, but you didn't do necessarily the narrative portion yet, right?
No, I mean, you say a lot, but it's a team. I mean, I was one of the people doing level coding and scripting and design, and I think at that point there were three of us in that role, and then we had a writer, Mike, working on top of that, and then Thomas as lead designer on top of all those, and then obviously, you know, artists and sound and all the rest of it. So it was a small team, but we all jumped in different locations, and obviously we were all responsible for different bits and then polishing each other's. It works really well at Frictional, actually. We have constant, because it's such a small team, we have constant, every couple of weeks we'll all play through each other's work and feedback on it, and everybody in the team gets to have a say and gets to push it in different directions.
That's fantastic.
Which is really nice.
Yeah,
there's some bigger companies I work for which really don't work that way, and you just sort of get handed a recipe, but yeah, it's good. So it evolved from what everybody put into it.
Now, when you guys decided to do Soma, how did that begin? Because I know it's very different from what you had done previously. I guess not very different, but it was pretty different, and I feel like it was ahead of its time, as it were. So who came up with the idea, I guess, for Soma, or how did you guys kind of decide you were going to dive into it?
So I came in after it had already been going for, I think, about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And Thomas Gripp, who's creative director at Frictional, and he came up with Amnesia and Penumbra. And actually,
Penumbra terrified me. Oh, my God. Well, so did Amnesia, but Penumbra, there's something about that. I just couldn't. The sound design in all of your games. Anyway, sorry. Go,
No, no, no problem. So Thomas came up with it, and I think he and Jens had been throwing around the idea of doing something in space, but eventually went for the ocean, particularly because you've got that weight of water on top of you, just is so claustrophobic, and a space, in a way, you know, there's thin walls out to space, but out there you kind of know what's there. There is nothing.
Yeah.
whereas undersea, we haven't explored anything of what's undersea, really. We've explored a tiny percentage, and you've just got this constant heavy pressure that will snap you in two if it breaks through the thin walls. So I think they saw it as a really, really good setting for a horror. And then really, I think Thomas's aim with with the game and an aim that he kind of communicated to the rest of us, was that he didn't want something which scared you in the moment, per se. I mean, having scares in the moment is great, but the real aim was for when somebody's put the controller down and they're lying in bed thinking, and it's the thoughts, you know, it's the thoughts that are running through their mind as they're lying there trying to get to sleep, which he wanted to be not necessarily the real horror, but certainly... Yes. Really thought-provoking and really kind of disturbing. What does it mean to be human? That was the central premise for the whole game, really.
Oh, and I personally, that's my favorite kind of narrative, something that sits with me when I watch the credits roll, something that makes me think, oh, wow, okay, there was so much there. I just want to pick it apart and go through it. Yeah. So
yeah. Well, I think one of the things that Thomas has spotted quite early on, and he's written a lot about this on the in his blogs on the website, is recognizing that people don't play the game that's on the screen. They play the game that's in their heads.
Yes.
They build like a mental model of what's going on and how the world works. And when, for example, you're hunkered down behind a box hiding from a monster that's walking past you, actually you're seeing a few black polygons because you're hiding behind a box, and there's some sound generated in some places.
Yes.
There's no real monster. You may never see the monster. It may be just a few sounds in an air vent. Well, there's no real air vent. It's just a collection of polygons.
Yeah.
And essentially you are creating this whole scenario. You're imagining the creature moving through that space. You can't see it, you can't look at it, you can hear it crawling along. And actually, if you go up and look really close at the polygons of that monster, it's probably really dull, and you can see its repetitive animations, and you can see that it's really badly put together. But the creature that's in your head is so much more compelling, and the rendering engine in your head is so much
yes.
more compelling than we can actually do. And it goes back to things like, you know, Jaws and Alien.
Yes.
You hint, you suggest, you sketch in the details, and the human brain does all the rest for you.
I think that's probably the most terrifying thing in Amnesia for me, was the fact that I'm terrified. Well, this is a machine for pigs, so I'm terrified of anthropomorphic pigmen, which is insane. I don't know why they terrify me so much, but I can't go to haunted houses or anything like that potentially have that. But so I'm playing Amnesia, and I think probably I remember you're describing sitting behind a box, but I remember a specific moment where I think it's like you're walking down a set of stairs and something just darts by across the screen, and it makes the sound of the pig like running by. And I stood on those stairs refusing to go down there for I think maybe 6 or 7 minutes, because I in my head I had it that, you know, they were right around the corner, and when I finally did it, there was nothing there. And I remember thinking, this is it, you know, this is what makes a really good horror game, is that I've gotten in my own mind, and I refuse to go any further because I'm terrified of what could potentially be there. But
and that's the difference with games, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the thing about sitting back and watching a movie is you are drawn along, and it's not you doing the pushing. It's
exactly.
not you making the moves. Whereas mm-hmm. you can stand at the top of a staircase and go, I don't want to go down. I don't want to go down. And have you played any horror in VR? It's even worse
yes.
in VR.
I did. Oh. I did one thing in VR, and it was the Until Dawn.
Yeah.
And of course there is, I think the second level has pigs in it. So I actually freaked out and took it off my head. But yeah, I probably won't be doing that again for a very long time. But yeah, it was very, very terrifying. But I think that's the future, actually. I think probably in 15 years or so, maybe even sooner. I'm not really up on technology, but I think most of the gaming will be in VR, and that's exciting, but also terrifying.
I'm not quite yet convinced, and I think it's because it needs a bit of a step change in tech, actually. Or a step change in consumer habits, maybe. It's got some brilliant stuff, VR, and some real potential, but it hasn't sold in big numbers into people's houses. It's not like the Wii, right? Nobody yet has come up with the killer app for VR which gets it into everybody's house, whereas Wii Sports, everybody got it.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
Your grandmother could play it, and it got into people's houses. Where I really see the current potential for VR is VR installations, so places you go to have an experience that you couldn't possibly have in your house, because maybe you don't have 15 square meters or whatever.
Oh, yeah, yes, yes, yes.
So there are a bunch of these things. You come across things like The Void, which was they did the Star Wars experience and the Ghostbusters experience, where you're walking around a kind of real maze that's made in out of simple wood, but then you're wearing a backpack and a headset, and the virtual world is mapped onto that real maze,
That is
so
so
you can
cool.
touch a wall. Yeah, it's that sort of thing. I think that's stepping through the door into Narnia for me, and right now. I think that's going to take off, those sort of experiences, which are almost theme park rides, I guess.
Yeah, I would do that. I would do
Yeah,
that
for
in a
sure, for
heartbeat.
sure.
Yeah.
And you'd pay quite a lot to do that, I guess. I mean, if you replace all the things out there, which were things like laser tag and that sort of thing, you take the same space and you turn them over
Yeah.
to that. Yeah, there's some incredible work being done on
Yeah.
those.
I used to, did you, are you familiar with MUDs?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, okay. So I used to do so much of that, and I remember thinking, wow, one day in the far, far future, humans will be able to just put on a game or a headset or something like that and visualize everything that's been written here in this MUD. So I would 100%, I'm the person that would lose my life in a virtual space. I would just spend all of my time there doing things. But I think there's just so much to learn about yourself in someone else's narrative, I guess.
Yeah.
So some of the things that I enjoyed, particularly, for example, Soma, I learned some things about myself that at some points were a little uncomfortable, like that scene. I think her name is Amy. It's been a while since I've played the game, but she's sitting there and she asks you, go get help. Like, just tell them Amy needs help. But she's clearly in a lot of pain. And she says, like, oh, it won't let me die. And players are stuck between, like killing her for mercy or just leaving her there. But if you actually listen to the dialogue, she never asks you to kill her. She never asks for that. She just says, in fact, she says the opposite, go get help. But I had immediately imposed my desire for if I were in her shoes, I wouldn't want to live like that. And so I think I had killed her either by accident or however it had happened. And then afterwards, when I realized that she never actually asked me to do that, I felt horrified. And that sat with me for a while, but I feel like I learn more about myself or my feelings and my beliefs sometimes when I'm playing another narrative or when I'm going through somebody else's story that they've created. So.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's empathy, I think. I mean, I think there's a lot of scope for putting you in other people's shoes, really giving you that other perspective. I think that decisions there are a series of decisions in Soma like that, which I think are really interesting because they aren't the standard decisions which people seem to ask for in lots of games, which is a branch that they're not a because people always kind of think about affecting the narrative by taking one path or the other. And they don't actually. The thing with Amy, you make a choice then, but it doesn't affect anything
No.
in the rest of the game. But what it does is it affects your own perception of yourself,
Yes.
your perception of the character you are playing. My character wouldn't do that kind of thing,
Yeah.
and that I think is a really powerful thing that often gets missed in game writing, because there seems to be this constant complaint. You hear it about things like Telltale, for example, where. I took this choice, but it didn't really have any effect. And actually, I think there are a lot of different styles of choice, and that one that you just described is as affecting as actually things which do make changes to the overall narrative. That just that effect of who am I? Am I the kind of person who'd do this? This kind of
Yeah.
role-playing choice.
Yeah. How much of this is role playing and how much of this is something I would actually do is something that bothered me a lot in Soma as well, or in any game really. I'll sit down and I'll say, what would I do? And then versus what would this character do? And I find it very interesting sometimes.
Yeah. Do you also find that? I certainly found this with things like the BioWare games, that when you play through, you kind of establish a canonical playthrough in your own head. This is
Yes.
my Shepard.
Yes.
This is her kind of story.
Yeah.
And then you go back and maybe try and play it again. And you find you can't because
Yes.
you can't.
Yes, I
You
was just going
try
to
and
say
take other
that.
decisions.
Yeah, I find I usually, especially a really heavy story-driven game, I will play it with a lot of choice. I will play it and then I will say this was my playthrough and this was my character story and that's great and fantastic. And then I don't have so much a hard time watching other people play and see kind of what decisions they make, but going back and trying again. So for example, Mass Effect, I think I played through the game and I've played through more than once, but it's always the same decisions that I made that first time, which is weird, but And then I tried to play a Renegade run, and it was so difficult for me because it just felt like my entire original true experience was different. But it was interesting. But yeah,
yeah. I don't think it's so weird to go back and play it the same way. It's only like rereading a favorite book.
Yeah,
really.
I guess that's a good point. It's an interactive book or experience.
Yeah, but what's so nice about those, and particularly I think I first noticed it in Mass Effect, is when you're seeing a character that you have completely defined the mm-hmm. appearance of. Mm-hmm. You're seeing them in the middle of the action, and you have the kind of depth of field shifts, and it looks like a movie and all the rest of it. And it completely feels like your story, despite the fact yes. you know there's only two voice actors, and they've pretty much, you know, mm-hmm. recorded the same thing. It's still your Shepard.
Yeah.
And it's so strange that we can come up with that idea that thing just belongs to us and it's a story just for us. And I think that's probably the massive thing that games do and that really no other medium can.
Yeah. I think it's funny because I remember when I was a lot younger, I think it was my mom telling me, oh, you know, games will die out eventually just because you just sit down and you play a story, but why not watch a movie instead, you know, with better graphics and things like that. And I remember saying to her, and this is when I was, you know, like 10 or 11, I said, yeah, but you don't play a 60-hour movie, Mom. Like, you can't, you know, like a JRPG is 60 hours long and you're doing side quests and you're learning about all of the characters. You know, I don't know. It's just, and holding that controller makes a huge difference. You are suddenly that person. You're not just watching. So,
yeah. Yeah, it's a very different feeling, and it's mm-hmm. it's stepping towards what I was talking about earlier about LARP, the kind of intensity of scenes, because you yeah. do feel that it's personalized to you. And it's kind of interesting, again, this idea that I guess linear stories or stories which you are slightly disconnected from, mm-hmm. like films, I guess, and like books, but books are really interactive because you conjure up images in
yes.
your heads. And
it's like what you were saying before yeah. about your own mind is, yeah. very powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. In a funny kind of way, cinema is less interactive than that, and sometimes mm-hmm. less powerful. But all I was going to say was, of course, before we had cinema, we had theatre, and before mm-hmm. that, we had storytelling. And I've done a little bit of sort of oral storytelling, and I've been to a number of storytelling conventions, and, mm-hmm. and it's a little bit like stand-up comedy in a way, and indeed GMing, because the storyteller will be feeding back off the audience and will be sensing their mood and judging yeah. what's going on, and they'll shift and change the intensity of what they're doing, and that adaptation to the exact audience you're in front of kind of personalizes the story for them. And I think that makes it much, much more powerful. Whereas, of course, cinema can never really do that.
Yeah. It's very intuitive, isn't it, actually, doing mm. either narrative for GMing or for LARPing. I imagine you must watch the crowd and body language and kind of derive, okay, they're either enjoying the scene or they're not, or they're feeling intense now. So if we play a sound right now, they'll feel a little bit more excited or not excited.
Sure.
So,
yeah. Absolutely. I mostly find that when I'm writing for LARP and designing for LARP, certainly, mm. I will do it on a kind of gut level.
Yeah.
This feels right. I'm not quite sure why this feels right, but this feels right. And wow. then when we run it and, mm. and the thing works, only then can I really go back and start analyzing it and go, okay, that worked really well. Why did
yeah.
that work?
Okay.
And go away and read some psychology and do a bit of a sort of study of how people behave. And once you've done that a few times, you start to get the patterns and you start to understand, if you like, the levers that you're pulling. But fundamentally, I think there's a story sense that you can acquire. And I think role-playing is a really good place to start with that. There is a story sense where you're keying into your audience and how they're feeling, which way they want to go.
Yeah.
And I think that's having that story sense is hugely beneficial, again, to things like games writing. And you can be an excellent writer without having that story sense. It's another tool.
It's a really
like.
Good skill set, yeah.
But it's a hard thing to develop, and it's a thing which I don't think is really taught at any level. It's a thing which you pick up.
Mm. When you are preparing for writing a LARP scenario, or even new inspiration for a video game, what do you have a process, or is it you're going through life and something inspires you?
Again, that's kind of hard. For LARPs, generally, we have kicking around a bunch of ideas of things that we would like to do. So it could be, for example, this coming March, we're doing a Three Musketeers game.
Oh, cool.
For a while. Mm-hmm. And it being Three Musketeers, there's a whole bunch of things you know should happen in a Three Musketeers film.
Those moments again. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You want the players involved to feel like they are a musketeer. So they have to have the things happen, or the chance to have things happen, that they would if they were watching the film. Because they see these things happen to the main characters. They go, I want to be that character. I want those things to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost about taking that genre, whatever that genre is, and going, how could we make the people involved feel completely like they're a part of that world and a part of that genre? And then we just start making lists. We want them to be able to swing from a chandelier. We want them to be able to have a carriage chase across a field, all of these things. And we go, okay, which of these can we do and how can we do them? And that, I think, applies to computer games in the same way.
Yeah.
I think if we were creating a new horror game and we went, right, okay, we want them to have a moment where they really feel claustrophobic, so maybe crawling through a tunnel. Where can we fit that in? How can we achieve that? What are the game mechanics we're going to need to be able to do that? With LARP, again, the other thing that we need almost always to make it work is a good site.
Yes.
So the place where we were this weekend for this Downton Abbey thing, or not, I mean, it's unbranded, sorry. It's not actually Downton Abbey. It's something very similar to Downton Abbey. The folks running that game managed to hire this amazing castle in Poland, which is now a hotel, and that does 90% of the work for them.
Yeah, I was just wondering that. Like, what?
Yeah, they don't have to do the set dressing or anything. Mm-hmm. You go in and this place just immerses you in it. It's hard not to be somebody in a country house in that time period, because it's all just there for you. It varies. I mean, we tend to do these quite immersive events, which we try and make everything within line of sight look and feel as real as we possibly can. However, you can have similar things which are not far removed from tabletop, where you'll be sitting in a small room somewhere, but you'll be acting out in the space as opposed to just sitting around with pieces of paper. So you can get to any end of the scale, really.
Do you find, I think instinctively, I assume that players would get more involved in a situation where, you know, they're in costume and the set and everything is set up. But have you also ever found that in a tabletop setting, characters lose themselves in the story that you've written or the story that you're telling?
Sure. I think it's part of this sort of story sense thing, is you find your characters doing things that you didn't expect them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think writers find that as well when writing novels. Often the sort of first pass in the book, the characters will start taking over and start surprising you. And it's all really, to me, it's all role-playing. It's all knowing those characters so well that you don't have to stop and go, what would they do? They just do it. And sometimes that works, and sometimes that's amazing. And often those moments are the things which become memorable because the characters surprise you, and that's great.
And then they all talk about, you know, oh, this was my favorite part, and you're thinking, I hadn't even considered,
Well, that's again, thinking about design, that's one of the ways we approach design, actually, that this was my favorite part thing. That moment when this happened. And we approach this thing that I call war stories, which is basically, if you have a bunch of people in a bar after the game, what are they talking about?
Yeah.
And when they're saying to all their friends, this thing, there was this bit when I was running from this monster and it was this, or it could be a little emotional moment. It could be a big Michael Bay set piece. But we almost design that way around. We go, okay, what are the things that they're going to be talking about?
Yeah, that's a good idea, I guess. And you mentioned that you sometimes, when you look at it after it's over, you say, why did this work? And that you look into human psychology.
Yeah.
So that's incredibly interesting.
Well, particularly for horror.
Yeah.
We did a ghost story a couple of years ago now. We hired a mansion on
Exmoor. You did not.
we filled it full of ghosts, which was so we know a bunch of people who've worked in the film industry. So we had stuntmen and sound effects and smoke and real fire and all of this kind of stuff going on. And a lot of that, because it was a ghost story rather than horror, I guess, it wasn't kind of gore horror.
Yeah.
It was much more spooky, more Woman in Black, if you know Woman
yes,
in Black.
Yes, 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 yes. which is the best kind.
Yeah, for sure. And for that, we borrowed a lot of stuff from, I don't know if you've heard of a guy called Derren Brown.
I have not.
He's a stage magician and mentalist.
Oh, wow.
Who does things like debunk faith healing, that kind of thing. But okay. he sets up these ridiculous experiments and these ridiculous stage shows and wraps a lot of them in sort of Victorian mysteriousness and that kind of thing. And a lot of the techniques that he uses and his co-writers use, and a lot of the techniques that people like Alfred Hitchcock use, we feed into the ghost stories. A really simple example, Hitchcock had this thing during the premiere of Psycho when it first came out, where he issued everyone going to the premiere with a little leaflet on how to survive watching the movie, how to not kind of have a heart attack. And he said, and we've placed a couple of paramedics in the audience just in case.
Oh, I remember anyway, that.
And the thing about that is what you're doing is you're just kind of screwing up the audience's expectations mm-hmm. so that they're there ready to jump at any shadow. And they do, like Thomas with the mental model, they do all of the work for you in their own heads. And it's what people like Disney are really good at as well for their design of the theme parks. Mm-hmm. The things that they put in the queues, the way they break those up, the way the architecture works to funnel people in particular ways. And you can use all that to get people into a particular receptive state. And then you can use that to trigger all sorts of stuff. Again, an example from the ghost story. There was a girl lying in bed. There's fire and smoke coming out from under the door. It wakes her up, and she can see the flames, and she can hear the smoke. No, the other way around. Yeah.
Wait, is she a player, though? The girl
She's
is
a player.
Oh, my
She's
gosh.
A player, yeah. Okay. So the door bursts open. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we've done the flames with a projector, and we've done it's real smoke, yeah. and we've put sound effects. But the door bursts open, and this creature floats into the room, turns and stares at her, grins, and then floats back out of the room again. So that's what she told us had happened. But actually, we built the puppet, and we know that it couldn't possibly grin. It had a fixed expression. It couldn't even turn its head
she
to look at her.
It.
But because she was so keyed into, you know, the effects and whatever, her brain filled in those blanks for her, and we needed to get her into the right state. Because we keyed them up for days, yeah. you know, before we even went into the thing. So there's so much work you can do by just getting the player into that state. And it doesn't have to be for LARPs. You can do the same for computer games. Again, Amnesia does it very well. And you can do it even through simple things like the design of your packaging and your loading screens and your pre-game kind of material, your posters, all of this kind of stuff. And if you're thinking of it as a kind of whole package like that, then you can do so much work. And it doesn't just have to be horror. I mean, it can be almost anything.
Yeah. Now, so do you, I have so many questions. Do you have a personal checklist of things that are maybe the most important to you when you're about to create either a game or a LARP scenario that are things you cannot skimp on? You know, like, for example, sound design in a
sure.
horror game. Like, I know that is incredibly important because it's very immersive for the player.
Sure. I think sound design to me is almost more important than the graphics because you can do an awful lot with smoke. You can do an awful lot with kind of obscurity and darkness. It's an interesting one. I think the key thing for me is always about the player first, putting the player right at the center of it. So a lot of what you get taught when you're learning how to write stories is about designing character, about designing plot, and about designing all that hangs together.
Yeah.
You know, things like the three-act structure, all mm-hmm. of that sort of thing. But actually, that forgets the player. And that forgets the kind of marriage between the player and the character. And so one of the most important things that I tend to do when creating this sort of stuff is to try and eliminate as much as possible the boundary between the player and the character so that you're always trying not to remind the player that they're playing a game. And one of the reasons to do that is because if you build that bond closely enough, if you make them feel like they are that person, rather than they're steering that person or they're, you know, pointing them in the right direction, you make them feel that they're totally embodying them. It means that when you affect that character, you're directly affecting the player's emotions. And it sort of boils down to scare the player, not the character. A really stupid, simple example I kind of use is Indiana Jones is scared of snakes, right?
Yes.
So here I'm playing Indiana Jones and we come across a pit of snakes. He doesn't want to cross the pit of snakes. Now, I'm not scared of snakes. So although I can understand that he doesn't want to cross it, I completely empathize with him not wanting to cross it. I'm sort of finding ways to try and poke him and push him across it because I'm not scared of snakes. However, if it's a height, I really can't stand heights and I'm right there and, you know, my pulse is racing yes. and all the rest of it. And so it's really about collapsing it so you're trying to make the player feel exactly what the character would feel. You're trying for the character not to remind the player that they're somebody else. So there's times in Soma, for example, when early on in testing, where you might go into a room and there's a body in the corner of the room. And Simon would see the body and say, oh, there's a body in the corner of the room, because we wanted to draw the player's attention to that. Mm-hmm. But because of the way it was done, and because maybe you were turning the camera to another angle or whatever it was, he might say, there's a body in the corner of the room. And you as a player would have turned away. You really hadn't noticed. And then you end up going, where? Where's he seen a body? Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
So at that point, the character's thinking one thing, the player's thinking another thing, and you're kind of broken out of the immersion between the two.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've seen a similar thing in games with choices, where the choices come up and you're going, well, I don't want to do any of those choices.
Yes.
None of those are the things I want to do. Or that time when you choose something which you think is going to have one effect.
Mm-hmm. And they take it a completely different way. And no, that's not what I wanted to do.
I didn't want to shout at that guy. Yeah. All I wanted to do was, So I think 90% of the work that we do with those choices, particularly in computer games because they're so constrained, is to try and put yourself in the player's shoes at that point and go, okay, what are the things I really want to be able to do now? Does the game let me do those things? And if there's no way, technically, we can let the player do that thing, how do we stop that desire? How do we shut that desire down? Mm. How do we make them not want to do that thing at that point? And so you will feel railroaded and frustrated as a player if, when you get to those choices, they don't do the thing that you want, or they don't have an option there for the thing that you absolutely want to do at that point. And if you can get rid of those, then the player doesn't feel railroaded because they go, oh, there's the option for me. It's right there.
Yeah. They are already empathizing with the character. So that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense, actually. So I have a couple questions about Soma because you mentioned it already. You said there were some things that really worked and then some things that didn't. What are those things that you guys took away after you finished the game?
So I think we very rapidly came to the conclusion that, and I think everybody else came to the conclusion, that the monsters weren't particularly well integrated, particularly the behavior of the monsters wasn't particularly well integrated with the game. And that was really a thing, I think, that we'd started to realize during production because the monsters had come in quite late in terms of tuning the AI was done after the level design was already done. And so that's really the wrong way around to do that because you want the levels to be built around the monsters rather than the monsters tweaked to fit inside the levels. And I think there was also a partly reaction on the company's point of view because they fully expected their audience to want it to be a horror and along the lines of Amnesia and along the lines of Penumbra. And I think they were a little bit scared of stepping away from horror because they were worried they might lose their core audience. Now, I think that's been proven for them that that's not the case, particularly by the creation of the mod, which disabled the monsters and has actually now they've created this an official option which is called safe mode, which leaves the monsters there but makes them non-threatening, and that's allowed an awful lot more people to experience the game and to play through and experience the story. And I think it's really taught them as a company, it's reassured them as a company that they don't necessarily always have to address the same core market. Mm-hmm. They don't always have to go for the same things. If they've got a different thing they want to say, a different type of horror they want to use, then it's reassured them that people will still buy their stuff, and that they can do that. And that's really nice. I mean, it's like the bigger companies, and I'm sure you've seen it, the money says, no, you must create the next shooter in the series of shooters, and it must be almost the same as the last few shooters, because if you deviate at all...
Like practically identical.
If you deviate at all, you might lose your audience. It's all about risk. And when you're dealing with massive companies, then it is all about risk. But I think it's let them have a bunch of new options when they're thinking about what they want to do next, really.
Yeah.
So that was... I guess I'd call it a thing which didn't really work, but some of it works for some players.
Yeah, I was going to say,
some players are really into it.
I mentioned on my stream that I was going to replay it without the monsters on, and a couple of people were like, what? No, it's way better with. So, you know, to each their own. Yeah. But
yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But isn't it nice that we now have the opportunity to have that kind of wide demographic?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
As well. So that was one of the things, I guess, which didn't work. I think things which worked, it all really came together towards the end. But those moments that we were talking about, things like Amy, things like the particularly spoilers, the body swap.
Mm-hmm. I think that
none of us in development, apart from Thomas, really realized what that was doing and what was happening there until I think we did the alpha. Because a lot of these storytelling moments, it's difficult to gauge how well they're working until you play them as one piece.
Course.
If you play an individual level, it just doesn't really work. And the voice acting helps hugely.
It's like a theater script. I remember reading scripts and be like, oh, okay, this scene is interesting, but the moment you do your dry run on stage and you've got everybody linearly working together, it's like, oh, I see, this scene is far more powerful now. So
yeah absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that surprised a number of us, and those turned out really, really well, and we're very pleased with the effect that it had on people. That whole thing I was saying earlier about putting the controller down and stepping away and thinking, and again the ending, I was particularly pleased with.
Was that your moment? Did you have a moment when you were during this creation process? Because I realize it must have been incredibly stressful to just sit down and kind of, you guys were probably working many, many hours. But did you have a moment where you watched something and you went, oh, wow, this is unlike, you know, anything really that's out there right now? And
that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
I think the body swap was a wake up as to this is what this game can do, and this is why you can only really do it as a game,
mm-hmm.
which I think is really important. But I would like to kind of leap in and say that the company wasn't working long hours, actually.
Oh, really?
This of all of the companies I've worked for, Frictional's launch of Soma was by far the most laid back and comfortable and uncrunchy launch I've ever done. Whatever those guys do, they do it right. And I was just so impressed by that, because I was genuinely nervous that everything seemed to be going too well, and where are all the bugs hiding? And sure, there were a few bugs, but it was really, really laid back.
That's actually really good to hear, especially right now when that's kind of the companies are under the magnifying glass as far as crunch time. And
yeah, absolutely, having been on the other end of it at other companies, it made a huge difference. But yeah, so that moment was certainly one of them. The other one that I was pleased, because I'd insisted on it and I was really pleased that it paid off for players, was the mirror. Because it was the idea that this is a game about identity, right?
Yes.
So you've got to give them a chance to look in the mirror. You can't just deus ex it and have a kind of slightly reflective looking thing. I mean, this is all about who you are. So we put in two, I think, moments to look in the mirror, and that paid off in two ways. One of which is obviously the sort of emotional moment of, oh, that's what I look like,
mm-hmm.
oh wow,
mm-hmm.
but the other is the cosplay that exploded out of it as a result, because people got to see Simon, and that is invariably the version of Simon that they cosplay as the one that they could see in the mirror. So that was lovely. Very pleased with that.
Well, Ian, this has been fantastic. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about narrative and everything today. I have one last question for you.
Sure.
What is your favorite war story that someone has told about something that you wrote or something that you designed?
Okay. I'm going to go for two, I think. One very briefly. One is simply that many years ago we did an Indiana Jones style event, mm-hmm. and there are still people who believe that we had a real World War One tank there. We didn't. It was built out of bits of plywood and stage sets and pyrotechnics and things. But the story was seen by a small number of people, and then the story has gone round and round, kind of people telling
it's
it in
grown.
Bars until there was a real one there. So that's one. The one that I trot out really is an example of design at lectures and things is again from our ghost story. So this was a 1950s Christmas ghost story in a big mansion, as I said, and it is 3 a.m. and you are lying in your bedroom upstairs with your partner in bed, and you can't sleep. The lights are on because you're too scared. There have been really weird things happening in the house for the last couple of days. And there's some weird things in this room. You've got pictures of a young couple in wedding gear. You've got a dried out set of flowers from a wedding. There's a cot. And there's a picture of a baby, and you know the baby's name because the name is on a piece of wood at the end of the cot. And you've heard people arguing, muffled argument through the walls, but you can never find those people. And you know that a young couple died here at some point in the past, but you don't really know the details.
Oh, my heart's already racing.
And you've heard a baby crying. You've heard a baby crying in the background, but again, you can't find the baby. And then at 3 a.m., you're lying there in the dark. Sorry, in the light, at night time, one floor up, and you hear a gunshot, and the door opens, and you hear the baby crying again, and there is the young woman, the bride from the photograph.
Oh, God.
She's in the doorway. She's got the baby under her arm. The baby is crying. She's got a gun in her other hand, and she's crying. She's got tears running down her face, and she runs distraught into the room, running away from the people following her. But there isn't actually anybody following her, but she can clearly see somebody, and she runs past the bed, kind of waving this gun. And you're tucked up under the covers, and you don't dare do anything because, hey, it's a ghost and it's got a gun. And she runs over to the window, and she raises the window, and she throws the baby out.
No.
And at this point, you as a player, you kind of if you can draw yourself away from what's going, you go, okay, it's all right. It's clearly a fake baby. It's not real. None of this is real. It's all fine. It's just a stunt. And at that point, the woman jumps out of the window, and so you go over to the window, and you look down, and there's nothing. Two stories down, there's nothing, there's no baby, there's no woman, there's nothing at all. And so that's something that was the kind of the big stunt that we did for that game, and we did it with a stunt woman, and we did it with a pile of boxes and pulling things out and all sorts of trickery like that. But the main reason I cite it from a design point of view is when we were talking to the stunt teams about how we do this, their first immediate reaction was, what if they get out of bed and they stop the girl? You know, what if they stop her jumping out the window? All we knew at that point is we wanted somebody to jump out of a window. And so firstly, we went, okay, well, how do we stop them getting to the window? Well, what if we put a barrier between the window and the bed? Oh, actually, there's this cot. What if we put the cot there? We can nail it to the floor. And, oh, that means she has a baby. Oh, and then we came up with a gag about throwing the baby out. And that's a nice kind of, you know, double bluff gag. And then the stunt team are going, but you can't possibly do that because if you put a baby in, they're going to be even keener to leap out of bed and try and save everything. How do we stop them doing that?
Yeah.
And then we gave her the gun. And it looks like a real gun, and it sounds like a real gun. They've just heard it fired, and it's being waved across their faces, and they're already scared in bed. And so gradually what we're doing by putting those little bits and pieces in, not only are we building the story, but we're shutting down the player's options because they are not going to get out of bed with a gun that they've just heard fired, with a woman that they know is a ghost, and you're making it – you're railroading them, but you're making them feel as if it's their choice and their failure not to take part. Does that make sense? And so a lot of that design comes down to that psychological, how can we get them into the sort of state where the choices that they want to take are really, really narrow, but they still feel like they had total freedom of choice.
And that's, especially in that situation, for me, if I was a player and that was either a scene in a game, I would then beat myself up for hours after playing that scene saying, why didn't I get out of bed to stop that?
Oh, yeah, sure. But on the flip side, she was a ghost. So you couldn't have done anything.
True.
That's sort of flipping it on its head so that we can make the player feel like it's their choice, their fault, and we can not get them into the state where they go, well, I would have wanted to do this, but the game wouldn't let me. And it's very similar to what we're trying to do, as I was saying earlier, in computer games. We never want them to say, well, I wanted to, but the game wouldn't let me. We always want them to say, oh, damn, I wish I'd done that.
I wish I'd done that, yeah. Do you ever feel like a villain?
Oh, yeah.
Do you ever feel like a superhero, but on a villain side? That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Knowing so much about psychology.
You do occasionally go, how far can we push this? And have we pushed this too far? We haven't broken anybody yet, but it's a difficult thing.
Is it something that you try to do? Do you think...
Break people.
You know, with each new project? Yeah. Do you think, like, I want to push it really far to the limit, or...?
Yes, but not so much in the horror way, in that what I love doing is giving people a thing which they can't believe is happening. which they yes. can't see how it's done. It's a magic trick. It's the old stage magic yeah. thing. It's
the illusion.
And that, but that doesn't need to be horror. That can be wonder. That can be, how is that person mm-hmm. just hanging there in midair? You know, that sort yeah. of thing.
Where I swung from a chandelier. Like, I can't believe
yeah.
I just did
yeah,
that.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we can do for each game one thing which they will always go away and talk about because they didn't believe it or because it impressed them so much or because they felt so much in the mm-hmm. moment, that's the war story that we want to be passed around for that particular event. And really, everything else is gravy.
Oh, everything else is gravy. I love that. So where can people find you, or is there anything that you want to direct people to? Like, particularly, I think we should mention, is there a way for people to do one of your LARP stories or projects, or where would they go to?
Sure. So
to do that,
I co-run a thing called Crooked House, which mm-hmm. doesn't have much of a web presence, but crookedhouse.org, that runs occasional one-offs of the sorts I've been describing. But really, if you have a search around the internet these days, there are so many high quality LARPs. There are things like the College of Wizardry, which is a little bit like Harry Potter, but unbranded. There's the Downton Abbey thing. There's a game where you can sail on pirate ships. There's a Westworld game. There's a
what?
There's a game where you can go down Route 66 as a touring band in a bus. You know,
that is so cool.
So it's really just a question of getting out there and trying this,
yeah.
because 20 years ago there was virtually nothing, and these days it's great, and I think it's an explosion of things like the fandom that you get around role playing and around movies,
yeah.
and things like the live Twitch streams that you've been talking about. It
yeah.
used to be that Dungeons and Dragons and role playing in general and tabletop was very, very geeky, but somehow it seems
oh,
to
yes.
be it's still geeky, but it's becoming very mainstream, and
yeah.
people are going out to escape rooms, and they're going out to zombie runs, and they're going out to secret cinema, and that's fantastic, and I'm loving that this live form of participation has become such a big thing. And actually, because of that, you can find these things almost everywhere now, which is fantastic.
That is fantastic.
So yeah, Crooked House is us, but we also work with a whole bunch of other people who are running their own things. As I say, it's very voluntary. It's very, mm-hmm. very hobby-based. Other than that, if you look at Tailspinners, that's the mm-hmm. games company, tailspinners.co.uk, and we do immersive things, and we do some LARP, but mostly we focus on story for computer games.
That's wonderful. And I, of course, those of you who are listening, all of the links will be posted down in the bottom as per usual. And thank you, Ian. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about narrative with me. It's been fantastic.
No problem at all. And I apologize for just keeping on talking all the time.
No, it was fantastic. I learned a lot. I had a lot of questions for you, but you answered most of them just through explaining and telling your story. So that was fantastic.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Once again, a big thank you to Ian Thomas for joining us today. He is the founder of narrative design company Tailspinners and the story lead at Frictional Games. And he can be found on Twitter at Wild Winter. And you can learn more about Tailspinners at tail_spinners or their website, tailspinners.co.uk. And thank you, divers, for listening. The Deep Dive podcast is brought to you by PBTV, and you can find us at deepdivecast.com. as well as on Twitter and Instagram at Deep Dive Cast. And if you like what you hear, please consider rating and reviewing the show on iTunes. And you can become a patron of the show by visiting us at deepdivecast.com/support. Patrons receive various perks like monthly black and white wallpaper, high quality versions of each episode, bonus episode content, and of course the knowledge that you directly are keeping the Deep Dive afloat. The Deep Dive podcast is proudly part of the Geek Generation Network. For more podcasts about your favorite geeky things like games or your favorite shows, browse our whole library at thegeekgeneration.com.